For that, I say this is.
Now, we're talking about that reading. With the room group from PLU of a January afternoon. This is a kind of a topic where sometimes I will be dropping my voice, I know unconsciously, as I pull back from some of it. So you have to let me know, hold a hand up or something over there so I speak up, please, okay? Let me start with a poem that every once in a while I use in a sermon. Some of you may have heard before, especially if any of you have been eavesdropping on the 50s. That's when it's from. The world is a beautiful place to be born into, if you don't mind happiness not always being so very much fun, or if you don't mind a touch of hell now and then, just when everything is fine, because even in heaven they don't sing all of the time. The world's a beautiful place to be born into. If you don't mind some people dying all the time, or maybe even starving some of the time, which isn't half so bad if it isn't you. Well, the world's a beautiful place to be born into. If you don't much mind a few dead minds in the higher places, or a bomb or two now and then in your upturned faces, or such other improprieties that our name brand society is prey to, with its men of distinction, that was an ad at that time, and its men of extinction, and its priests and other patrolmen, and its various segregations and congressional investigations and other constipations that our full flesh is heir to. As the world is the best of all places, for a lot of such things as making the fun scene, making the love scene, making the sad scene, singing low songs and having inspirations and walking around, looking at everything and smelling flowers and goosing statues and even thinking, kissing people and making babies and wearing pants and waving hats and dancing and going swimming in rivers on picnics in the middle of the summer and just generally living it up. Yes, but then right in the middle of it, comes the smiling mortician. Getting ready, I've done a couple of times, talked about my wife's death and my grieving of it here at the village. And I put things together a little differently today for me, and I've said to others, it's part of my grieving to do this. So I'm grateful for the opportunity, although I can't say that I enjoy it, you know, in one sense of the word anyway. I pulled out some letters from my file about connected with Ginny and stuff, and I found some letters that I wrote to people at the time of deaths, and I was sort of interested. I wrote one for a rabbi. I won't read much from him. I called him, what do we say after we say goodbye to a rabbi, to my rabbi, to my teacher? Frank Rosenthal was my teacher. They used some of that in his memorial service, I'm really proud to say. And then I wrote one long one that I won't read to you for a dear friend who committed suicide. A lovely agnostic. Let me read it. I like it because it says that. His name was Jack. He was a Ford dealer. Pretty well to do. I knew a man who claimed he could not know God very well, yet prayed each day en route to people and business that he knew all too well. I knew a man who repeated often that he didn't believe enough. Agnostic, he said. I just don't know. I know a God who knows all men and women well, and business and art and earth and sky and computers and histories and time and decisions and choices. I know a God who says faith like the smallest seed is much, much more than enough. Who won't snuff out small, smoldering wicks and still answers before we ask and while we speak hears. I know a God, in earliest time and now, for Christian and Jew and mysteriously for all who in ways beyond deciphering hear God's voice, has grace and mercy and love and compassion abundant, whose ways are higher than my ways and whose thoughts higher than my thoughts. I know a God who knew a man. I still miss Jack. And then, I don't know how many years ago, two dear friends of mine found out that their 22-year-old daughter took an overdose and died suddenly in Minneapolis. They lived near me, And I wrote this letter to Ann and Bob. It's meaningful to me because Ann died about 4 weeks ago. This happened about 6 years ago. The suddenness of death. Suddenly is sharp, you never know. Suddenly is cold, relentless, draft. Suddenly is forever and ever, like in Handel and love songs and doxologies. Except it's for real, and it's for now, and it's for keeps. And suddenly everyone seems to speak a foreign language. And it's still for keeps. And the only hope is remembering thought, word, feeling, muscle, nerve ending, deed. In whatever way possible or impossible, who it is that's doing the keeping. In response to that note, Anne wrote a book called A Handful of Thorns. It's about that death. When she died about 4 weeks ago, she still hadn't gotten over that death. And she called it, Grief is a Solitary Journey, a Hidden Handful of Thorns. Real pathos in this. Let me share just a couple of them. Here's where she tells you to shut up if you're going to help her in her grieving. Do not tell me of the research that measures and defines what I feel, that builds a reasonable structure in which I can contain my grief. Do not bring me the books that give me a comprehensive analysis of steps and stages with reasonable suggestions on how to get through and over this pain. Do not counsel me with equations. Patience plus work multiplied by time equals a reasonable recovery. I am not a problem to be solved. I will feel this pain for longer than I can now imagine. For this unreasonably bad, there will be no end to my wailing. Perhaps God will hear and stay to listen. Perhaps God will let me have my grief. And I think Anne did. One more. The difference between day and night when you grieve. Day is for pretending. There is no desert, for showing a contented face, for working in accustomed ways, for saying the familiar and expected words. Night is for knowing why I'm in pain, for looking in my hand and wondering how one song, one blossoming forsythia can be so full of thorns. The whole last section of the book picked up the foreign language stuff that I put in that poem. She talked about being in a foreign country, not being able to talk to anyone. There are different kinds of grief, of course. I'm going to talk about one person's experience of that grief, strictly mine. I'm glad to share that with you. As I said, it's part of my grieving to do that. But in no way am I suggesting, hinting, that this is a way to do it. Way to be about grief. All it is one person's experience. It cannot imply anything more than that. No trying to set up a way to go about it. It happened uniquely because there were unique situations and unique people, and that's all I have to offer. I am aware that there is grief, though, that's connected with death, which is kind of what I'm going to talk about. That's a grief of a spouse. That's quite different than a grief for a parent. Quite different than a grief for a child. Quite different from a grief for a friend to whom you are not committed or married. There's grief at divorce. There's grief at loss of a job. At the loss of friendship, of course. Loss of, or at failure, at moving. There's one sense in which Holden Village is specializes in grief because we're always saying goodbye to people. During the summer, it's for almost a half hour, continuous every day of the summer, we hear grieving about people leaving us. It's sometimes very strange kind of business. There are kinds of responses to grief too, probably lots that you could list. There's this outpouring, letting it flow. I have a friend whose daughter was murdered a few doors from my house. And that was a little over 10 years ago. And that house is still filled, and I mean filled, with pictures of that daughter. And there's almost nothing else that mother talks about. it still goes up. There's repression of it, of course. Run from it, deny it, do whatever you can to get away from it. There is the winter of the heart, a way of talking about it that Martin Marty writes about. This is at the death of his first wife, Elsa. A cry of absence, reflections for the winter of the heart. Some people have live in the summer or the spring or even the fall of the heart. He lives in winter, and this was his reaction to it. I think a very helpful book. And then there is just the response that life goes on and that changes will be made and time will take care of it. I don't think I come to any of those. A fellow who wrote Good Grief, Ranger Westburn, first written, my gosh, 62? Seems he was even before that. Anyway, this is for those of you who may be Lutheran, Fortress Press. This is the longest, largest selling book in the history of the company, yes. In the hundreds and hundreds of thousands, probably millions by now. And he just caught something very early, and that this is used in many hospitals and other places to help people understand what grief is about. So it's still, a good kind of a book that specializes that there is there's something to be learned and something to be felt in dealing with this ongoing thing that lasts so long among us. Time will change it. But he suggests, like Kubler Ross, there are ways of going about it. I think he had at one time 20 stages to be into. I've never known what stage I'm in. I bounce back and forth. I'm here, there, and tomorrow I'm at the end of it. The next day I'm at the beginning. It just doesn't make any sense to me. Those are helpful things to think about, but I just don't. I don't know. I have no idea where I am, nor would I try to predict. So he was here summer before last. Stranger was chatted with us, and he kidded about that. And he might have to find a whole new system for me, one that is fluid, like one of these water slides or something. I don't know. One-liner from C.S. Lewis, there's no nonsense about the dead. There's no nonsense about the dead. And his book, long ago, again, this back in the 60s, Instead of Death, Bill Stringfellow wrote a book for teenagers on death. He says it's an essential teenage problem. Our society denies that it's anybody's problem. And he thinks if you don't start working on it in your adolescence, far, far behind, and it ought to be done at a good, better time. This thing just came out again in print. I think the Seabury Press brought that out again. One more quote. Let me tell this story. Frederick Buechner writes that he had a dream, and in the dream, he was in a hotel. And he remembered very vividly the hotel room that he was in. And it was a room in which he felt extremely satisfied and marvelously good, connected to himself. And he just reveled in being in this place and enjoyed it and stayed longer than he had planned. But finally he left and went on his way. And many years go by in his dream. And suddenly finds himself back in the same town and sees the same hotel and immediately remembers his experience and goes and asks the clerk, I'd like to stay in your hotel and I want to stay in a room that I had the last time I was here, which was years ago. But he says, then the fellow says, well, sure, you can stay in any room you want. Which room do you want? He says, well, I don't know what room I was in. And the fellow said, well, if you tell me the name of the room, you certainly can be there. And he said, I'm stuck. I just don't know. And he said, oh, yes, I know what room you mean. The name of the room is Remember. If you ask for the name of the room, Remember, you can have that room back. And he did. And was filled
once again with all of the peace that he had experienced before. Grief has to do with a room called Remember. I have remembrances of earlier deaths, grandfather, grandmother, my mom, my dad, one of my brothers, yet I got three brothers, aunts and uncles, a couple of friends. One that I missed because he did his exit so quickly in a tent at Lake Tahoe. Never had a chance to deal with that, still don't. Another woman who called long distance from Long Beach to say goodbye. A long conversation, ending with saying to Jenny and to me, "Are we waiting?" And we cried most of that night. But the real winner was, of course, the death of Jenny. Jenny died March 8, 1984, maybe 2 years and a few weeks. We were married by that time, 35 and a half years. As I said the other day, marvelous, imperfect marriage, the only kind you can get, and exciting one, and a marvelous one, with plenty of faults like her husband, same way. We were here at Holden, and in 1982, for 3 weeks, and headed off to San Francisco, and had a marvelous time down here, did some teaching at Berkeley Seminary, went to School of Theology at Berkeley, and specifically, and then went home to an operation that Ginny had lined up before for gallbladder. She was bugged by this, and all the good traditional gallbladder signs. And sitting in St. James Hospital that morning, waiting for the cart to come, she already had her shot, she looked at me across the room and just said, "You know, I've never been in better shape, physically, emotionally, or spiritually." And at that moment, I didn't tell her this. About the only thing I didn't tell her is that in that moment, flashed through my mind, what if this is a tough operation? But I didn't say it. And so I went and waited in the room, and I waited in the room, and I waited in the room. And I got scarier and scarier. Was it supposed to take them? Finally, a short Jewish-looking doctor, surgeon, came in, said to me as I was writing bills, we've been gone for a long hours paying them. He says, "Can I talk to you in this room?" Which is the same thing as saying, "Your wife has cancer." And here's a little guy I'd met once before in my life, gives me the worst news. "Your wife has widespread cancer." Many things happened then that I hope never happen to me again. The first was telling Jenny, because I asked him to let me do that. And I waited at her bedside, and when she asked me how to go, and the tears I had to color didn't go too well. And she said, "What do you mean?" And then I squeezed out the words, "It's widespread cancer." And she swallowed and breathed again and said, "I can live with that." And as I sat crying with her, she commented about how glad she was that we had been in therapy. She just said it this way, "I'm so grateful for Bob Postal." That's our therapist. We had been in therapy quite some time, a number of years before. And I sort of was startled and looked at her and said, "Oh yeah, it's really going to be helpful to you in, you know, dealing with this." And then I stopped and said, "And for me." And she said, "Yeah, that's what I meant. Way ahead of me. Dealing with my grief already, and I was thinking how I'd been helped by a therapist." And then I had to call the kids and tell them. Another thing I don't want to ever do again. 4 or 5 kids in different parts of the country and tell them, your mom has cancer. And widespread, that adjective got in there all the time. Scared the daylights out. Turned out she lived 19 months. But at that moment, you know, we didn't know whether it was a half hour or a week or whatever. And finally getting to the car and just screaming like mad, pounding that steering wheel to break it if I could. I summarized the rest of it pretty quickly to tell you what happened, and then I'm going to give you some of my reactions too, because that probably will tell you more about, maybe as much about what happened. We got a second opinion, and the guy said, yeah. Or to quote him, there's a hell of a lot of toxic material in that woman. Which is a doctor's way of saying she hasn't got a heck of a big chance. So she went in chemotherapy, eventually had 3 or 4 regimens of chemotherapy, some of which did some good, some didn't. Eventually had some radiation, lost her hair quickly, had a contest with finding a new wig, and people designed crazy wigs from all over the country with mops and all that stuff. And I forget what the prize was. She gave a prize for the person designing the wig for. We had some lovely pictures taken. I forgot, I could have brought those along. There's one where both of us are wearing a wig. I have one, she had more than one wig, and we both had a wig. I had our picture taken together, and the other one, both of us without any hair on. And we just wrote at the bottom, the more you live together, the more you look alike. Her idea, and a fun one, we really enjoyed. The crazy thing is that she looked great. In November, before she died, in November of 83, she was in to see the gynecological oncologist, and we were pressing him for, you know, because then we knew we were coming to Holden. We had been interviewed, knowing that she had cancer, and we're coming, and she wanted to have some hope that she was going to get some time here. And he said, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, tell me about that. He said, okay, if I read your chart in the next room, I didn't know you. I read your chart. I walked in the room, looked at you, I'd say, excuse me, and walk out. You cannot be the woman on the chart. She looked healthy. Good shape. You wouldn't have guessed. No one would guess. That was about November 10th, and by December 10th, it started. And by the end of December, we knew, on the 10th of January, the doctor said, nothing we can do. We can give you maybe another 2.5 weeks by cutting you up. And Jim reflected about that and said, no way. And we called all the kids and got their opinion. And so she decided to come home, give up all any kind of care, and come home to die. Wanted to die at home. And We thought it would be 2 or 3 weeks. You know, can't be long because the last meal she had was December 25th, Christmas Day, that she could keep down. And she died March 6th without any food and very little fluids in the arm. Or she had a Hickman catheter. I was so proud of her. People would come to see her Hickman catheter. They weren't that popular at that time. Insert it in, and then you put it over, instead of jabbing the arm, you just connect it and all that stuff. And so we show off of her Hickman catheter. But it took her 9 weeks to die. She said, I can't even die well. She was bothered about that. She wanted us to get on our way, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But, as the nurse said to her, she said, why can't I die? She said, why shouldn't you die? You have all your kids around you, your husband's around you, everybody's taking care of you. You're having a great time. You're not going to die that fast. You're enjoying it. And of course, finally she did. Kids were all able to be home, all 5. First, we had them come at different times because each wanted their own time with them. And she had long talks with each one, good closure with each of us, including me. Each of us slept with her one night in her hospital bed at home. She was straight as can be. Don't let anybody get in there and not talk about death, not talk about life and whatever it's about, and get them all cleared up. Anything hanging in, she really went after them. her neighbors are always came in and said, oh, you'll be all right. And I said, no, no, I'm not. She says, God's curing me by death. I'm going to die. That's how it will cure. I didn't like that. You know, you have to make it nice. Touch became a marvelous, important thing. She would not wear any clothes. That was, she'd say, freedom, freedom. That means get these blankets and stuff off of me. And she didn't want anything on her. And then we, all six of us, would massage her at the same time. And she would say to us, you know, I hope you understand how much your love comes through me by your touch. And if one of the kids or I weren't particularly good at rubbing her neck, you know, why don't you let somebody else do the neck? Why don't you do the feet or something else? She'd move around. She was going for it. All the stuff that she missed or felt she hadn't received, she was going to get it and did. And it was marvelous. The tough parts were the long nights. And she would be not really sleeping, but thinking, experiencing. She experienced stuff on a higher level. She said, I don't know what it is. She talked to me about it. I made notes about it. Something beyond the human experience. She says, I know it's going to sound weird, but there's something going on. I don't understand what's going on, but it's pretty good. It wasn't like, you know, ecstasy or anything like that. And we laughed a lot, an awful lot, made fun. Not dodging, because we cried a lot. I don't know how many times she thought she was going to die. It was a false alarm. And, you know, we'd be exhausted, and she'd go merrily on her way, you know, in the process. And we'd go in the other room, just about 4 o'clock. But, like one time she was experiencing something, Tom was sitting on the son Tom. And it was during the night, and all of a sudden she eyes open and she says, oh, that's how that works. And her eyes closed again. She never said what in the world it was. She discovered something, and we wondered what, we still wonder what the hell is she, did she understand at that moment, that there was something going on. She wasn't in pain, and that makes it so different. Because we weren't torn up, you know? She was on a low-grade Dilaudid. She had to take it rectally, because, you know, nothing would go through the system anymore because of the cancer had clogged the intestines. We all were the nurse. You know, I'd give her whatever she had to do, and the kids wouldn't. It was a big schedule. We kept her very much on schedule because that was the best way to do pain control. And one night, during the night, Anne, the oldest girl, gets up and inserts the Dilaudid rectally. She thought, and then Jay says, you just inserted that in my vagina. Do you want to remove it? So, took it elsewhere. But there was lots of craziness like that. And she talked to us about all the people she knew, remembrances of them. Lots of it we did too. And then the last 40 minutes, that was pain. And that's the part you remember, can't erase it. The last 40 minutes are the main remembrance. The breathing, the tough, when you wanted to stop it so that she would stop being hurt, and when you knew that you couldn't or you wouldn't because that meant the end. So she finally took one, skipped one breath, and then took another one and stopped. Wasn't much left to her body anymore because she starved until the system stopped. And we left her lying in her bed without any clothes on where she wanted to be. And then began the whole process of remembering. That's the story. Here's some of my responses. I remember too much. I remember too much. The deep sense of her absence. The deep sense of her absence. More than any symbol or picture, I have a picture up in the chalet. That doesn't bother me at all. She is present with me in. I don't hear her voice, I haven't talked with her, any of that business, which is a real sense of her presence. sometimes much more than others, and sometimes pretty intense, that makes it uncomfortable. So I have that kind of intense feeling about her, I can't reach out and touch her. I never liked being with people I can't touch, anyway. C.S. Lewis writes in his book, he needed, when his wife died, he needed her reality, he didn't need her picture. She was so much more than a picture could be. His book, A Brief Observed, by C.S. Lewis, read it right after God, he wrote that book inside my heart. Marvelous understanding of what it's like to lose a spouse. Such depth and such scraped all, what all kinds of stuff, shavings and whatever outside of me, out from the inside of me. And I remember too much because I'm aware of what's missing here at Holden Village because Gideon's here. Not only for me, but for the village as well. And I become aware of that. That's when you see me in a mood or in a crying or whatever else it may be. I remember too much. And on the other hand, I don't remember enough. Grieving, seems to me, is what you do with your remembering. Gathering the loose stuff, or pulling it tight, or throwing it away, or whatever you do with that, or distance, or run after that remembrance, imaging what she's like, and what she left. She asked me what I wanted to take from her. And that was tough. That was tough. And I finally was able to tell her. And afterwards I had to add to it that I had to also take from her some understanding of what it means to grief. The second reaction is learning how to live with loneliness. I'm a person who loves solitude, but of course loneliness is different from solitude. For me, loneliness had to do with separation from someone. And that separation was usually Ginny, because that was the person that I had to share with. And then she's gone. And that intimacy, that person, that other person that's there to give all of whatever you are at the moment, excited or half dead or whatever it may be. Working at finding ways how to tell other people how lonely I am or in what ways I feel cut off from myself or from others or certainly from God. It seems to me the denial of loneliness is the denial of death. Rich Becker's book, The Denial of Death, seems to me a fundamental book. Dealing with this in all of its depth, it's a tough book. Nature of humanity, I suppose, is to fear that. The thing that gets us all quiet when a death like that announcement of the space shuttle is that finality. Third thing is people. What I remember, and the remembrance process has to do a lot with people and what people have meant to me. The opposite of death for me isn't so much life as it is friendship. And people were really the ones that helped out. Not looking for a replacement of Ginny in my life, but people to feel with me in my grieving, whether that's people for short term or long term, whatever it may be. The family, terribly important. We're closer than we ever could have been, just because of heaven. We still don't like each other all the time. We still fight and all that stuff. But there's a bond that's so different. My relationship to each of the kids is drastic because of what we could be another way, and I say guys can be better, grateful for that. They're human beings, they're friends to me in ways that. And what I wasn't ready for was how much they were going to miss her. They miss her perhaps more than I. That's crazy to say. I don't think it's possible, but it scares me sometimes when I'm with him how much they miss. Tom gets all bleary-eyed and he says, I meet people who will never know what my mom is like. And gets torn up. It's been tough. Anne has a baby, Kristen, that her mom will help her raise. She gets torn up. It was positive that often people were distant from us, were more help than our immediate friends. My closest friend, I mentioned, I think, the other day, he and I have been friends since 1938. I've known longer than I know Jenny. And he was so grieving, he couldn't do anything for me. He was all torn to shreds. He couldn't help out and reach out and lift me up in any way. He just cut to pieces. And so it was often people distant from us. Jenny worked for the National Conference of Christians and Jews in Chicago. And the plate of, what did they send? Some ham and cheese. I always thought that the National Conference of Christians and Jews was nice sending ham. The platter of ham and cheese coming at the front door from that outfit. And that was one of the things that really meant a lot. Why that one should, but it did. One of those crazy things. Another friend who hadn't been over our house very often came over during Jenny's dying days with her collection of teddy bears. We put them at the end of the bed. And had come pick them up afterwards. What that visit meant to us. A couple of marvelous friends, Joseph Sittner, Mark Marty, over at the house regularly. Joe's a retired theologian at the University of Chicago. He'd see Marty on campus and say, well, I'm going out and get a shot from Jenny. Because she wouldn't let him escape either. She'd say, what's this all about, Joe? Where am I going? Where are you going? How'd you get there? And he wanted to know how a woman that grew up in Missouri Synod background, much more of Missouri Synod, by the way, than I ever was, had come to the point where she was. And then she wanted to know how Joe got to the place he was. He had to unload in front of her with Marvel. So there were people like that. They weren't very close, but they were a little further away. Not a lot of, I'll say more. But then there was a memorial service. We had a quick memorial service. She died Thursday morning, Sunday at 2 o'clock, in a memorial service in Chicago. And got 700 letters in the mail by 5 o'clock Thursday afternoon. We had written them already. She had okayed them, which is sort of a weird kind of a thing. And about 500 people came from all over the country on Sunday afternoon. Just blew us away. People hopped on planes in Connecticut, Alabama, Minneapolis, flew to see. This woman who didn't complete first year college and so long was embarrassed by her not having a college degree, had people of renown, to me anyway, in the church, standing around crying because of her departure. And those who would have watched me saw me smile, because I knew it. I knew the quality was there. That often she didn't believe it. It was in therapy for a long time to try to get to it. Marvelous service. Tom played for 15 minutes before the service. He wanted to play, and he was afraid to ask Jenny if that'd be all right, because he thought he was pushing himself. Jenny talked to me and says, I'd like to have Tom play, but I don't want to ask him, because it might be too tough for him to do. So I thought, maybe, why don't you two get together and talk about that? And they did, and she said she really wants him to play. And he played for 15 minutes before the service began, and I could have left then. The whole memorial service would take place for me. That music. He was, and it all happened at that point. It was marvelous. Because it was a deepening. As the tears came, so were the laughter as well. And as I said, it's her own laughing at her inability to die on schedule. She said, I came home to die when she made that decision.
and thought I was coming home to have some serious, deep thoughts. The first thing I got home, God told me, she said, to darn the socks. And then she got all of our slides in order, because they had all been butts in the box. How can I die with all these slides messed up? So, she did all of that kind of stuff. Gave gifts to other people, lots of stuff, because we were moving in the house, so things to remember. Did lots of great things that way too. Taught us something about giving that way too. And in the midst, there was hope, crazy hope. Hope is not optimism. Hope isn't saying it's going to work out nice. Hope says there's something else going on besides what you have. And for us, that hope was knit together with our belief in Jesus Christ, a God who is merciful as well as really to remind us of what it means to be faithful. And I suppose that's the stuff that lasts most from Jen. Is that she was a woman of hope and showed that in ways that she said were easy. It's really even not that tough to start. See, I thought it would hurt more. Maybe the Lord had helped, I don't know. But that spark of hope that was there, again, is a gift that we carry. The kids do, and I do. Can't be the same again. I mean, we will never be the same again. But we will also never lose that gift that she gave us. I guess that's as much as I'd like to share. But I'd be willing to chat with you about any part of it. Or something I didn't say, or something that sounds phony or fakey. There was, when we were all there together, that was not easy. We had to get out of the house. We get in each other's way, get on each other's nerves. Wasn't, you know, I'm not talking about a pleasant experience. That part was tough, for sure. We were all first-class human beings, good and bad.
I understand more now about the good part of being the sadness, the crying, the you know, that feeling, and that it's okay to do. And I'm wondering, is it because maybe you're so used to feeling happy or trying to be happy that you're repressing them, or are you? I almost feel that we're talking about it sometimes so much that it not just being, not just accepting it when it happens, mm-hmm. but that we have to look for it. That doesn't seem right to me either.
Yeah, it doesn't to me either. If you talked to me, you know, before July of 1982, I wouldn't know what the heck you were talking about. I don't know. I wouldn't know about grief or what to do with it. Right? I'd have manufactured something as a, you know, I'm a word monger. So I'd have said something about it, but it wouldn't have been saying anything. And during the time that Jenny was in care and all that stuff, we weren't sitting there saying, getting ready for something. We lived in lots of, I suppose, optimism, because the therapy kept her looking good, although I guess we still knew inside that it was wouldn't have been. It was only when that time came when we knew, then we worked on whatever it was with her. And some of those sessions with her were terrible, terribly painful. Suppose one could say about me that I am happy a lot of times, but I'm also a guy who enjoys tackling the tough stuff. A couple times today already, or whatever. That's part of my life, too. I don't, you know, again, in the same sense, enjoy that, but I wouldn't want a life that was, quote, happy or nice or boring.
But joyful.
Yeah, I mean, that I would survive, that I'd get through the day and something good would happen out of it, maybe later on, but that I felt I lived.
But I think you're right. I think going around just kind of sidetrack whatever was happening. And we just never knew. Well, there was no plan. There was no, what happens if you do this? I don't know. It was weird. The unpredictableness, you know, then and now. Like I said, you know, not being fitting into some mold. I don't know when it's going to hit or what's going to cause it. Could be driving a car. Could be late at night, early in the morning. It could be not for a couple of weeks. I don't know. I just don't, you know, I don't feel myself ready for what's going to come bounce back.
Do you feel that you would have been angry at God or maybe had a different kind of grief if it had been a car accident and you didn't know she was ill and was going to die?
I think, I think our family was given a special gift of trying, and a special person who was able to talk freely about herself. And before her therapy, probably not. I don't know what the heck it would have been even if the same thing had happened before she'd been in therapy for a long time. Yeah. I don't know what it would have been like. Just a friend of mine, just his wife, went to the corner store, came back across the street, and was killed instantly. Nothing more than that. I don't know what I'd done. Yeah.
How did the therapy that you just mentioned help?
Oh, it helped her to get to accept herself and believe in herself after a childhood where that had not been possible for her. And to be convinced of for her own. And to be convinced of her own, of her respect. The therapist was not Christian. It was not, you know, Christian therapy in that sense. But getting her to the point where she could accept what she had come to know about God as something for her. But it was really a conviction of her value and her well-being, which was about 3.5 years worth of therapy, plus some shock treatments, by the way, which we terribly regretted, some of the dumbest stuff we did. We had a life filled with dumb stuff. So it was a long and tough battle.
After she died, did you seek out any special person or special thing to get support from, or did you do it on your own, would you say?
No, I did not seek anybody out, because 4 days later I moved out of the house and came to Washington. What I wanted most, my recollection of what I wanted the most, was to be alone. And Tom and I drove out in the car. I think on Thursday, she died on Thursday, memorial service Sunday, and the following Thursday, the big van, Allied van, pulled up and took the stuff. And Friday morning, we headed off, Tom and I, and I think we hit Wenatchee, like on the following Wednesday or something like that. And then Tom, and we had a good time together, I mean, quiet, silent time, most of the time, driving across the country. Then I wanted to be alone. And I spent the next week, more than that, I forget how many days, 8-10 days, by myself. I just had to be freed from being around people, feeling the pressure and all that stuff. And then this place took over, as far as whatever happened for me. I think had I not been coming here, A, to a new job and a place, and the things I mentioned before that I think have been blessings to me here, then I probably would have been seeking something. It also has given me chances to talk about it, like this is, and that's been therapeutic for me. Each time I talk about it, I see it a little differently.
Isn't it really true, though, Elmer, that none of us gets to practice going through this experience before we, actually face going through it, and having dealt with so many people with a death experience, every last one of them was totally different. You wanted to be alone, but there are others, who are just absolutely frightened to death of being alone.
Absolutely.
And can, you know, the grace of people is important,
sure.
But the, there have been times I've been said to people or persons who have lost a loved one, you may experience needing to pray, Lord, you know, I know about my enemies, but would you please spare me from my friends? You can have that kind of an experience too.
Okay. What role did family, friends play in the process from the point of diagnosis to the point of death, as far as, you know, them being a support to her and to you?
Very, very large. Some friends, maybe four or five, played a strong role in that. An illustration, I mentioned Marty. When I called Ann, and she was the only one I could get, the oldest daughter was the first one I could get to tell her that her mother had cancer. And, you know, in a public phone and all that stuff, not even a booth, you're standing there pouring your guts out and bawling all over the place. And it's a crazy thing as you look back at it. And, of course, she's torn to shreds. And she said, Dad, why don't you call Marty? And I hadn't even thought of it, because he had just recently, before that, gone through this death. And so I grabbed his number and called, and I couldn't get Paul, and I couldn't get all the rest of the kids, and I called Marty. And he was stunned and all the other kind of stuff. But just said the right things. And then later on I found out he just called a bunch of people right off the bat, and he was immediately working on it. And then I reached the other kids, and then my best friend came over, and we spent about 8 hours just, you know, hanging on to each other that after seeing Jenny. And I went home that night, and about 11:45, the phone rang, and it's Marty. He says, it's going to be tough to go to bed tonight. And he talked to me about that. So he was one of people who was sensitive and knew when the points were going to be, and he was really great. And then the kids too, I think first it was all floundering. The rest of the family is not. We're not very, very close family. I lived about 20 miles from my next oldest brother, and I saw him maybe once every 15 months. You know, so we were close. It was the immediate family. But they were terribly important. And after the kids got back and saw Jim and had spent some time with her, because as soon as they heard widespread cancer, they thought they'd come back and see her, and she would be yellow and, you know, thin as whatever, and she was still healthy looking, then they felt better, and then we were able to work at helping each other. There was a woman at the university that I worked at, came over those first days during her lunch break, sat in the couch in the front room and let me put my head in her lap and cry. She did that 4 or 5 days in a row. Didn't talk much, just knew I needed somebody around, and I'd just lie there. If you had told me in advance that Sue Brown is going to be really important to you at this moment, I'd say, Sue Brown, why? But third place. So it was that kind of stuff. Again, unpredictable. I would never know. Yeah. I wrote something. Strangely enough, in 1978. So something, somebody, something, somewhere was working. Let me close with it. Death is very, very old. Older than Methuselah. Death is very, very new. Newer than a child born this past second. We sometimes say death comes stealthily, without warning, surreptitiously. But death is not sly, nor clandestine, nor quiet. Death is no secret. It is announced in birth, it is seen in life, it is felt, it is even believed, but seemingly never known, truly,
but in our very own experience. And this for me is the grace of God, that in between birth and death, we see, feel, believe, experience, and sometimes even know life. As we are called by the earthly Spirit of God, gathered with chunky, clunky people of God, of black, red, white, yellow hue, enlightened by child and grand mothers and fathers, by word and world. We work in, play with, celebrate over, suffer through, share amidst, hope for, the moment of being even more fully alive, more fully known, more fully knowing. Like death, life is very, very old. And like death, life is very, very new. I believe that.